Well, John is uploading it. Basically, the LTIIPH project is awarded to APHL and TSJG based on the PAT work and the FLIP work that has been done so far with our expertise we gained during that process. So that's the pretext of this whole foundation for LTAP. What I'm going to do in this presentation is just give a very high-level overview of what LTIIPH is, including what that acronym stands for, which is the first bullet there, Laboratory Technical Implementation Assistance for Public Health. And we'll go into more details about what it is and what we're trying to do there, and then hand it over to Eric, who is our vocabulary subject matter expert, both on the PAT side as well as on the LTAP side, so he can walk us through some of the reusable tools or reuse tools that we that gave us a good jumpstart in LTAP, while a lot of parallel efforts have been happening in this space with respect to electronic lab reporting. So, coming back to what LTAP is, that's what it stands for. It's an Our High Tech grant. Its basic premise is, you know, as it says, public health. So it's both public health labs and public health agencies. And primarily the focus is getting electronic submission of lab results to the local jurisdictions and to the local public health agencies or departments is the primary focus in alignment with the meaningful use stage one objectives. And also enhance the LIMS capabilities primarily on the electronic test order and results aspect of LIMS. So it's again another data flow, data exchange between your lab service requesters and lab as a lab, you know, you're providing that service and sending the results back. So those are the two primary objectives for this assistance model, very specific, very targeted assistance. And then our approach is more consultative, not prescriptive or enforcer. Like, you know, we're there to work with the organization we're going to provide assistance to and fit the different best practices within their context so that they can implement the ELR or ETOR, depending on the case. And at the bottom, you'll see the ELC grantee list. ELC is lab capacity. I don't know what E stands for, forgot. But ELC is another CDC grant. But this one, this specific ELC, is also our high tech grant. There is several ELC grants out there. This one is ELC our high tech grant, which LTAP is a companion grant. So there are like few grants that were put together by CDC in the space. One is the LTAP to provide assistance to ELC grantees. The other one is the SureScripts, the one we had a little social event Monday evening, and then there was a presentation on Tuesday morning, I believe, on the LIC grant, which helps the hospitals to do the ELR with their respective local jurisdictions. And then there's another FLISA grant, which we'll talk a little bit about. So there are several R-HITECH grant. LTAP is one of that, and our primary focus is to help the ELC grantees. So what are we trying to do as part of the project? So as you can see, you know, the public health agency or EPI within the state local jurisdiction is in the middle, and ELR is coming from different areas, you know, and the focus or the scope for us is more the white circles, not the gray circles. So the public health lab sending to public health agency, the hospital sending to public health agency, the ELR with respect to the meaningful use, that's the key data flow we're focusing on. And as you see, that is a serial number one, against reportable lab results. What else? The second priority is electronic lab test order and results. Ricky touched on ETOR earlier, but that ETOR is more specific to a public health lab sending to the CDC for reference testing or similar testing, or a public health lab sending to a different public health lab in terms of the surge capacity and other scenarios. This one in particular is more like the primary or reference testing within the state local jurisdiction where somebody is requesting the public health lab to perform a lab test for them. Right, so this is a different use case, but the idea is similar concept. The data may be different, you know, the level of detail you request may be different, the level of detail you may want to include in the message may be different. But those are the two data flows we're dealing with or we want to address. And again, just to be sure, the number one The number one is our primary priority, because that's clearly aligned with the meaningful use stage one objectives. Okay. So I'll go a little bit into the, you know, how we're implementing this assistance model. Some of it is a derivative of a PAT model. Some slight variations in terms of this project, but we'll cover a little bit of those things before I hand it over to Eric. Program approach, we kind of did a high-level scope matrix just because there are so many acronyms for floating in this place, in this space, as well as the different data flows, ELSM, ETOR, ELR, NEDS reporting, case notification, case reporting, you know, they're different. So a whole variety of things, and then if you put that all into the meaningful use context, again, like, you know, what are we talking about here? So we put a high-level scope matrix at that level saying, like, you know, what use cases are covered within LTAP from assistance perspective, as well as we created a menu of services. So it's a big catalog of services categorized into two sets, the general assistance, which kind of cuts across all the 10 grantees we're working with and kind of forms the common framework. And the targeted assistance is more like a unique assistance. If somebody, one of the grantees require a specific assistance, then we would address that in a one-on-one basis. So those are the two kind of buckets that we have created in terms of the menu of services. Primarily, general assistance deals with a lot of ELR and ETOR kind of data flows, and that's what the focus has been. And as part of the first phase of this project, and the second phase, we may jump into a little bit of the targeted assistance. We did a current state assessment, and then we also, if you look at the flip model, if the PAT ELSM model versus this, we had to do a little bit of a balance of effort, you know, a level of effort between how do we optimize our team's assistance in terms of just going and assisting one-on-one, or are there some areas where we can provide some common foundation, common framework, that way, you know, we are working together in a collaborative fashion across the 10, with the 10 grantees, and then start looking at the one-on-one assistance after that. So that worked out very well. You know, during the first 6 months of the project, we kind of did that common ground, common framework, common constraint profile, and various different things, virtually or a lot of live meetings and whatnot, and also tagging on top of that the one-on-one assistance, including site visits. And then also we wanted to leverage the webinar concept to, you know, once we reach a milestone in the project, you know, you got a nice work product, you want to share not only with the grantees, but, you know, share it with a broader audience. We have these webinar concepts which we've been using quite successfully. And from an assistance approach point of view, you know, let's say ELR 251 implementation, we went with the typical IT model, right? The design, prototype, pilot, rollout, and operations. And of course, you know, we got to learn from each of these steps and see how we can tweak the previous step. And then we picked one of the grantees as our pilot to do the whole thing, and then also roll out across the, all the rest of the grantees. That was the model we started off. You know, we quite didn't follow the same approach, but we started off like that because, you know, the ELR is ELR across the different grantees, right? So we do have all the top parts. Just the rollout is where we kind of probably did some mixed approach there. But in general, we are working, and our approach has been like have this common foundational framework and then work with each grantee to see what their requests are. Because some grantees have very good good capacity within their teams from a skill sets and resources point of view to take care of certain things, versus some grantees are not. So so those are the kind of different criteria that helped us along the way in the project to adjust our course so that, you know, we're still providing the best outcomes. Vocabulary and messaging guidance. We formed the vocabulary core work group across all the 10 ELC grantees. And the interesting part here is the work group consists of both the lab side and the AP side. So which is unique or not, but definitely novel in my limited experience in this space. And it kind of makes sense because we're dealing with ELR going from the lab to the agency. So we need both ends of the table, right? So, and I forgot to mention one other point. When we looked at the circle diagram earlier, this particular ELC grant and LTAP grant focuses on the public health space, and there's a reason for that. The meaningful use focuses more from hospitals to the public health agencies, right? That's where the incentives are. That's where the dollars are. Nothing for the public health. But public health agency is expected to be ready to accept those interfaces when the data becomes available. So CDC came up with this idea of providing this ELC grant and LTAP grant so that if you focus on the public health lab able to provide a 251 message, right, you're making them at par with the meaningful use guidelines so that, you know, they're not behind when it comes to the, you know, the hospitals and others. And at the same time, by focusing on public health space, the public health lab is sending the message to public health agency. So now you're also making the public health agency ready to accept a similar message from the commercial side and from the hospital side when they are ready to send a similar message. So it's a nice way of structuring these grants so that, you know, you're empowering and positioning the public health space to be ready for the meaningful use when the hospitals and others come knocking on their door saying that, hey, we are ready to send you a message. Are you ready? Because if you're not ready on the public health agency side, they're scot-free, right? I mean, they still get their dollars because they were ready. You were not ready. So don't make that. So that's the vocabulary core work group concept we introduced and implemented. That served very well, not only for a lot of these activities we're going to talk here, but in general, that's been a good knowledge sharing, best practices, compare notes kind of forum across the different across all the grantees. We developed the ELR 251 constraint profile, which is a derivative of the ONC spec, right? I mean, ONC spec is there. We took it as a baseline and then, you know, further constrained it to suit the implementation that is more practical, I guess, if you will, for implementing. And then we also went ahead and did the disease agent prioritization process because there were like, you know, if you look at this, each jurisdiction level, there are at least 50-plus reportable conditions, right? Same as the national level NNDs as well, you know, around 60. So we don't want to boil the whole ocean. We want to just start small. We want to get the ELR workflow implemented so that you can just add more diseases to that same solution architecture. At that time, you're dealing with more data management rather than technology so much, right? I mean, at least that's the concept. And RCMT, NCMT, as it was called before, you know, it was all, they were kind of forming and norming around that time. So we went with these six diseases as our pilot group, and this came out of our current, remember when we said like we did a current state assessment, we kind of compiled the top five across the 10 grantees, you know, where are your top five in terms of reporting, plus we combined them with CDC's priorities. So in essence, we came up with this pilot group, and the reason we want to do that is so that we can have the vocabulary map for those six diseases. So the grantees can pick the disease or one or two diseases of their choice and get with their initial testing stage, which you know CDC has a milestone end of this month, August of this year. Each of those 10 grantees I showed earlier should have at least tested their message from public health lab between public health lab and public health agency. So that was kind of driving us to have at least a pilot group and get the work going. And then, you know, obviously we're going to leverage RCMT for tier two, tier one, tier two. What we mean by tier two, tier one and tier two is like, you know, there are other diseases we didn't look at initially from a mapping and you know, a local to the standard mapping point of view, which, you know, we put off for the later part of the project. So completed the vocabulary mapping for the pilot group, lying for tests and resulted tests, SNOMED CD for test results, and specimen SNOMED CD for specimen. Of course, there is a HL7 lookup table also. Eric may allude into that or talk about that a little later. But from our point of view, SNOMED CD is what, you know, we'll be using as a standard. Probably chart is a little bit busy here, but you know, we want to explain the collaboration framework we had as we were doing all this. It just didn't happen in vacuum or in silo within the LTAP or ELC grants. We talked about the core group, which is all the our high tech grantees, the 10 jurisdictions I showed earlier, and then we also had some participants who showed interest, Utah and California. They joined as participants, and then the LTAP team was facilitating this whole process. And then we're also plugged into RCMT refresh. We're plugged into the different community of practices. Of course, we're plugged into the National Task Force to compare notes and see what we're doing makes sense leveraging each other's work. And then the LIC grant we talked earlier about, you know, the ones who are going to work with hospitals to send a similar ELR message to your local jurisdiction. And the FLISA project is another Aura High Tech grant. That's the legend here. All the blue boxes are Aura High Tech projects. Through FLIP, FLIP ETOR, as Ricky was mentioning earlier, FLIP ETOR is kind of doing some pilots with FLISA grant, right? So that's our touch point with that group. So there's a lot of this may not be a comprehensive list as well. As I'm learning more about ELR in this conference, there's a lot more parallel efforts happening. But as you know, based on what we know or what we knew at the time we formed this team, you know, we still had thought of involving or getting plugged into as many avenues as possible so that we're not operating in silos. Because it's all about interoperability in the end, right? The other things, as part of the messaging guidance we did was, position statement, clarifying reportable lab result specs. You know, if you look at this is the ONC spec as it reads, you can read it, but, it was also interpreted, wrongly that, you should use lawing for lab test results, which is not the case, right? You use lawing for resulted tests. So we wrote a position statement pointing out why that's not the case, why SNOMED should be the results, and kind of went sent it through CDC, through ONC, got approval. And so those are the kind of things we also are doing as part of this project. We talked about the webinar concept. Here is one example. Eric did a wonderful webinar in terms of comparing the 231 and the 251 message, because ELR is only 251 and a lot of states already have 231, so we kind of took a stab at comparing the two. We also did a preliminary comparison between eLinks and FLIP ETOR, because ETOR is not the only spec out there when it comes to electronically exchanging lab tests and results. So there are some discussions earlier on to see which one is what. So we did some preliminary comparison as well. So as you can see, it's a variety of things, but tightly aligned with meaningful use as much as possible has been our focus. And then on the technical implementation side, we got some data flows, design choices, prototype, conversion, and testing framework. A couple of slides, and then I'll hand it over to Eric. And data flows. This is a typical ELR data flow, public health lab doing extract, transform, encrypt, and send message. Very similar to ELSM, right? I mean, they are doing the same thing. It's a different use case, but the process is the same. And we call this ELR. We could just label this as ELSM, and it's still is the same concept, and you change this bug to CDC, right? So from a workflow process point of view, the architecture is very similar. You can scale depending on, which one you're implementing first at the lab. If you're implementing ELSM, you use the same infrastructure to do your ELR. If you're implementing ELR first, you use the same architecture for ELSM. So there's a lot of similarities that can be leveraged across the two projects and in terms of strengthening the lab capacity for electronic data exchange. So again, our focus is this, but just for comprehensive sake, if it is non-public health lab, a hospital can send a similar message to the agency, and agency will be doing just the same. So that's our focus. Now, this is a little bit drill down view of the sender side, what needs to happen. So you got your manual test results into the LIMS entry, and then these are your different technical components, and this is your automation logic. Basically, the first step is you need to identify it's a reportable disease or not, or is it a reportable condition or not, right? You don't want to send all conditions, all test results to your agency. You want to send only the reportable conditions. So how do you do that? And then once you get that part, you extract the information from LIMS, and then you need to perform transformations and translations. That's the typical local to standard mapping, like a lot of the links and SNOMEDs and whatnot, and as well as constructing your 251 message. And then you send it to the public health agency or the wire, right, electronically. So you got to do your encrypted message, and then what path you're going to use to transport the message. So these are the typical things, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we also put together a little bit of each one of those things. Identify reportable diseases can be implemented a variety of ways. There's no one solution here, right? Same with map local codes to standard codes. Again, a variety of ways. how are you going to construct your ORU, R01 message, variety of choices, and how are you going to send it across the wire, variety of choices. We kind of laid out all the different options there so that depending on the grantee's context, they can pick what makes sense. Sometimes I've seen, we have seen like in a combination of this and this to do this. As long as it works and as long as that's what you want to do, fine. As you know, the ultimate goal is the message is what we're looking at the interoperability point of view. So tomorrow when you need to send it somewhere else, it's the same message you're sending regardless of who the receiver is. That's and then on the prototype, we basically focus on the sender side. And 2 and 3, meaning in the previous illustration, which is the mapping to the codes, the standard codes, as well as compiling the 2351 message. We use Orion Rhapsody as a tool because that has a pretty big footprint across the 10 grantees we're working with. I think 8 of the out of the 10 have Rhapsody alone, and then the other two, one actually has Rhapsody and something else also. So, in essence, what I'm trying to say is Rhapsody has a bigger footprint with our grantees, so we picked that tool to do our prototype so we can go there with something in our back pocket to start off rather than starting from scratch once we do on-site visits. And MQF, the CDC message quality framework, they have put together some tools out there, so we use that tool to jumpstart our sender profile, and then, of course, we have our pilot group of diseases to move on. Give to Eric.
Hi, good morning. My name is Eric, and I'm going to follow up with from Srinath with the vocabulary and messaging. And so we're going to go back to Ricky's slide from before on some of the tools and processes that she pointed out. And so we used most, if not all, of these tools, but she was very modest in her Ricky way. And there's a host of other things that we've stolen from the Flip experience to leverage and help us kind of hit the ground running with LTAF. And I just also want to mention it's Ricky, and then I know most of you may have heard of Jerry Sable. He also helped create some of these tools, too. I don't want to leave him out of the picture. He's another terminologist that works with APHL. And so he has some great stuff that I latched onto and used for the LTAF project. Okay, so I'm just going to kind of split it out into vocabulary and messaging. That's kind of what the terminologists at APHL have kind of evolved into. We're kind of not just looking at vocabulary, but we look at the message and the vocabulary, and it's really kind of helped us kind of look at vocabulary in the context of an HL7 message, as well as looking at it from the clinical view, from the bench view as well. Okay, so for vocabulary and Flip being reused in LTAF, Ricky managed to message. She mentioned the data collection sheet. We just lifted that up, made a few changes, and used that to try to get the information we needed. As Srinath had pointed out, we tried to go ahead and map an initial 6 conditions just so we'd have a baseline to start our testing with. And as it turns out, we had had to make some adjustments along the way because it turns out a lot of our grantees were kind of ahead of the game on mapping. So we were just kind of collating a lot of the information and mapping when mapping needed and making some recommendations on certain mappings. But that was a kind of a pleasant surprise. It helped us move forward. There was initially, through Flip, a harmonization effort of some reportable conditions. I think Ricky did about 20, along with several of the Flip partners and CDC. They started trying to do what's called a harmonization project and try to come up with some common, among them, harmonized LOINC codes for conditions. And that was kind of a really ambitious project. They were looking at both the order level as well as result level. And so I started off with that information. Since then, Jerry's been hard at work at the RCMT table, and he's created a really nice product that I've kind of co-opted or kind of superseded that harmonization effort. And that's also a working project, and we'll probably take what we've done in FLIP, but just, this is an aside, and try to help move that RCMT project forward tomorrow, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, tomorrow. We'll be there tomorrow. Okay, so let's get back to my slide here. Encoding guide. We really didn't nail down the a value set for each LOINC. That'd be a great idea, but since we're dealing with a different use case, we had 10 different jurisdictions, they had 10 different requirements, it really didn't fit what we were looking at. I know there was, we had some desire for that among some of our grantees, but it's really hard to, when you have a single receiver, like CDC EPI, it's much easier to identify what your value sets are going to be. So we didn't really use the encoding guide for tests and results. We did use it in a way for certain special vocabulary that I'll get to in a minute here. And the next item on the list I have here is a specimen cross-mapping table, and I want to direct your attention to our poster we also have in the poster hall, and that's something that Ricky started with. Did I mention she was very modest? She listed like four things on her slide. We've taken all this stuff from all that early efforts. I mean, it's incredible. And as an aside, I was working with Ricky in, was it 2004?
2004.
In California at the Department of Health, actually for UC Davis, and that's where I met Paul Duffy. Uh-huh. And then that project expired. I went back to my clinical work, and she plugged away through APHL, and then she calls me up 3 years later and says, hey, can you help us out? So it was quite a transformation from that early work to what we're doing now. So it's kind of a cool little aside there. Anyway, we have in the FLIP eTOR project, which is electronic results and orders, the FLIP eTOR team was struggling with the vocabulary because the version 2.6 message also has an SPM segment. And in that segment, you're looking at using specimen type, specimen source, and so forth, using a vocabulary that's descriptive and well-defined. Now, the HL7 specimen tables are neither. And so the decision was made in eTOR to go ahead and define things with the SNOMED CT nomenclature. And so she started early on trying to collate and put together a list of terms and try to come up with a constrained list of SNOMED terminology to use for describing specimen. And so I took that initial list and I kind of ran with it to help map all the grantees' local specimen codes into a local mapping to SNOMED CT with that. And it was able to enhance that table and add a lot of terms to it or propose a lot of terms to SNOMED for it. And that's become a project that we're working through the lab. Is it VM?
Lab Messaging.
Lab Messaging COP to, along the lines of an RCMT call, to try to come up with a list of SNOMED terms, that a constrained list of SNOMED terms, or a so-called preferred list of SNOMED terms for specimen type, and how to describe specimen. And it's a little more complicated than that, so I'd like you to go take a look at our poster. But that's an exciting area where we're continuing to work on, and it's a work in progress right now. But our hope is to replace, in the end, hope is to replace, there's a little column in, a little table in the ELR 251 guide that says under, with vocabularies, and under specimen type it says TBD, to be determined. And we'd like to replace that with a table. And so that's kind of the end goal. I'm interpreting that right? That's what you want to? Yeah. We want the TBD to be, Ricky's specimen cross-mapping table. So, and then the next item on my list here are mapping conventions, terminology conventions. There were a lot of work done early on in FLIP through their core work group meetings, and there's a lot of, back and forth, and they developed these conventions. And a lot of those conventions, I just co-opted and said, this is what, let me have some examples here. This is what, for example, they created a primer that defined things that are really hard to define, like indeterminate and equivocal. And Paul's back there laughing. I listened to some of those calls or read the notes on them. There was just kind of all this back and forth trying to define these things. So we actually made definitions in FLIP. And in the FLIP ELSM, there's a primer. It has a definition. So I've kind of used those as guidance for some of these more difficult concepts for the LTAF project and for the ELR reporting. And then overall with terminology and FLIP, we've come up with some, you know, best practices, kind of a FLIP best practices. And we tried it for coding and general mapping code as granular as you need, but no more. So that's kind of the Goldilocks analogy there. You're not too hot, not too cold. You want to have some granularity there, but you don't want to go overboard because there's a ton of loinks out there. You can get really mired in mapping if you get too granular. And an example is, you know, and typically we really encourage people when they are doing loink mapping, just get a little detailed in the weeds here a little bit, but there's a specimen component to a loink code, and we just really do not like to use that because that just, you know, explodes your number of codes. So we try to avoid that and use the specimen segment for things like that. That's a simple example of that. Okay, next slide here. Special vocabulary having. I'll go over that in a little. I think I might have an example of that, maybe not. But we have to create all these for these programs. You have program specific vocabulary in like FLIP ELSM for influenza. There's all these epi related questions. We have things like if you don't have an age. A date of birth in your message, we have a field for, you know, patient reported age, and we've created these conventions and how to report them in the message. And there's questions, I call them OBX sections, but basically questions for the specimen, especially eTOR, where you're submitting a sample, and we have all those extra questions. I mean, are these other identifiers there? Do you have a PulseNet ID or something like that? And all these questions that CDC requested. So through that process, we've been able to tabulate a bunch of these questions, and some of these questions are going to come up in ELR too. So I've just, you know, been able to anticipate some. I'm finding some through my discussions with the grantees. There are a lot of questions, extra questions that don't fit in the message proper. So we can't find a field for them. So we're creating this special vocabulary section to use and trying to create a convention to use some of these questions as an OBX segment in its own epidemiologically important information. That's really hard to say, but I got it out. Section, observation section. Next slide here. Here's an example of our cross-mapping table. I just want to, you can really encourage you to go to the posters. There's a lot of good posters there. There's a really good poster from a student about what I learned is that, you know, you draw a, this is an aside, you draw a clock by hand, and it'll tell you how much, you know, if your brain's failing on you or not. So I've been drawing clocks every day now to make sure. So that's an aside. That was a joke. Here's our specimen cross-mapping table. Just to point out, if you don't get to the poster, we call it a cross-mapping table because if you look at the third line, you can't describe. We've developed a preferred name as sort of an index, and there's a couple more columns for description and definitions exactly. And so you have to use more than one term sometimes to describe a concept. And so we're trying to create this list. So again, that's a work in progress. Join the if you're interested in this, go ahead and look at PH Connect for the lab messaging COP. We're continuing to work on this, but that's an exciting thing that's come out of FLIP eTOR. We've leveraged it for the LTAF, and we're kind of working now in collaboration to try to move it forward. So on the messaging side, Ricky talked about a messaging template. I call it Jerry's worksheet.
That's right.
I think Dave's going to take credit for it, too. He's sitting right there.
He's using it all the time.
Okay. Jerry Sable took the ELSM guide and he created this basically it's a table, a static definition table. And what it is basically a static definition table from HL7, and instead of removing all these subcomponents, I put them all back in there. So it's really explicit. It takes and gives you a contextual definition of what each element is. It has comments from LTAF. I call them LTAF comments. There's ELSM comments. In Jerry's version, I made them LTAF comments. And also, there's examples. And if it can be hard-coded, I put a little hard-code example in there. I say, yes, it can be hard-coded. And I really kind of just literally lifted this from Jerry's work and the work in ELSM and just basically plunked it into the ELR 251 guide and created we call it a message link template. And then I also took that and leveraged that to create what I call mapping matrices when we do the up converts from a 2-3-1 for a local jurisdiction to like 2-5-1. I use that, and each column has like a little couple extra columns that direct as a guidance and also as a documentation for what the mapping's going to be. It's a document. It's not an actual machine mapping, but it's kind of giving some guidance on that in that direction. Okay, and then what else is on my list here? EPI important information conventions that I've from the previous slide, and how to report those. And so we've come up with some conventions for that we took directly from eTOR. You create your NELSM, you create your own order observation segment to list those questions. Again, with specimen, there's an OBX segment or an observation for the specimen. There's a lot of other information you may have about the specimen. And that's more of a vocabulary thing. I don't know why I put it in messaging, but and then as Srinath had spoken about earlier, one of our not our primary focus, but our secondary focus is on electronic order and result messaging. So in other words, taking a electronic order from one of your partners, your hospital partners at the public health lab, and then resulting out those results, acting as a reference lab and doing this electronically. So lo and behold, Flip has the eTOR message that we're developing, and so that is really, and especially the order message. We have an order message that's being worked on, and then also a results message, which is 2-6. But we're not necessarily restricting it to that, but that experience and that knowledge is really helpful and useful in moving forward with this particular part of our project. So one of the artifacts, I guess, I hate that term, but that's one of the documents we created, is the constrained profile where we've taken and using kind of an Occam's razor approach, I've constrained the guy down to make it simpler, easier to get a first pass implementation on and get our testing started. And what we did is went through the work group, the ELR work group, and went through this guide and kind of took out all the optionality by eliminating it and then adding back what we thought we needed and creating this guide and then putting some special vocabulary in there we talked about for specimen and EPI information and created this guide. And then this is what I wanted to point out, and it's really hard, it's too small, but I just wanted to. The things in the circles are kind of the extra columns I added to the static definition of the ELR 251 in our constraint guide. And so what I just wanted to point out with that is we have definitions there. We have constrained profile, we have a context definition of the element. So instead of just saying, I can't even read that, but instead of saying, oh, it's over here. Oh. I can't read that either. Okay. instead of saying alternate identifier, it says the local ethnicity code. So instead of having that generic HL7, name, we put context to it, which I think is helpful. Can it be hard-coded, yes or no? What could the hard-code value be? Your limbs weight here or something like that. And then some context-specific comments there. So I took the PID for ethnicity, stuck it in there. And so they've created this constraint profile, which is kind of a first step or just kind of a baseline for our grantees to use to, create their initial message, an implementation guide, and then they can add to it. And then there's a whole section, like I said, on special vocabulary for specimen and for those epidemiologically important or relevant questions that may not be in the guide. We have 1 minute? Okay. So... So I just wanted to put a plug in for this guide. It was a nice product. We got a lot of feedback on it, and we were able to use it, and we'll be hopefully being able to tweak it a little more as we move forward. So I have half an hour. Okay, I have to talk a lot more. Okay, and so finally, I wanted to go over briefly some of the intangible things that we picked up from FLIP and really the knowledge and experience that we picked up in those FLIP projects, ELSM and eTOR, and then sure, we had to make a lot of adjustments when we went to the ELR 251 project from those two very defined receiver and sender applications of ELSM and ETOR, but I think we were able to hit the ground running, and our success to date, I think, is a large part due to that being able to leverage all the information and knowledge and experience we had from the flip work, and also the quiver of tools that we were able to take from them. So I'd also wanted to point out that there was a lot of relationships that were developed through APHL and FLIP, especially the PAT teams going to these places, that created basically a lot of goodwill and a lot of willingness to trust us. You know, trust us, we're the government, I guess. trust us, or at least give us, you know, the time of day to go in there and help out. And for example, Dave Sanderson was a technical lead for ELSM, and he goes into a place like Rhode Island, and he kind of is like the shock troops. He goes in there and loosens them up, softens them up a little bit. So when we come in, it's, you know, they're really willing and ready to go. And I think it was really a nice revelation on my part to see that. So with that, I just wanted to say that I think APHL is now offering a lot of knowledge and bringing a lot to the space for the broad goal of interoperability. And I want to thank everybody in this room for listening. And right now, I think it's time for questions. And if you want to moderate.
Yes. So we have some time. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Ricky. And for questions, I've got a microphone. I know we're in a small room here, but we do have some folks online, and they're also recording this session. So if you have a question, I'd like you to ask it in the microphone.
Yep. Hi, I'm Mary Kate from Virginia, and I have a comment and a question. My first comment was when I was looking, Eric, at your slides about reportable condition mapping, and that happens at the laboratory side. I just wanted to make a comment that in our state, we actually go ahead and send everything to our health department, and they go ahead and pick out what they want to look at. Yeah. I think one good example of this, in our state, we're actually under two different secretariats even. We're not in the same department, the health mm-hmm. department and the lab. But I think a good example of this, like in our case, would be like a mumps test. Our tests are notoriously insensitive for mumps, especially among the vaccinated population. So the health department wanted to know if we'd even performed the test.
Uh-huh.
They don't necessarily need to know if it's positive. They want to know if anybody even suspected it enough to order a test.
Mm-hmm.
So just things like that. So they wanted to get all of our data. So that might be one more thing that you'd like to add to your algorithm, is that reportable condition kind of mapping. You know, the RCMT might actually happen on the public health agency side mm-hmm. rather than on the lab side.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that was just one comment. My other question was that Susan and I act as the terminologists in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we've been struggling with as we map our local codes to the standard codes is there's a lot of issues. But one of the things that I thought would be really useful, and I don't know whose purview this would be really fall under, whether it be FLIP or LTAP or even under, like, say, Regan Street or something like that, but to approach the vendors, especially for things like chlamydia and gonorrhea and HIV, there's a couple of big vendors who provide those tests. And I know FLIP for ELSM approached the flu lab at CDC, who provides the PCR tests to the labs, in order to help determine what the proper loinks and SNOMEDs are associated with that. And I think it would be really nice if we could have that same relationship with, say, GenProbe or Evalee or something like that, who provides the HIV or chlamydia gonorrhea. And, you know, I mean, there's a couple of standard tests, especially within the clinical labs and the state labs, that, I think could be incorporated. Wouldn't it be beautiful if it was incorporated into the product?
Yeah. So sort of move upstream from public health to the source.
Exactly.
The same with specimen.
I mean, I think
Same with specimen. That should be actually at the EHR level is what we're getting comments and feedback from. If we can get those people involved at this point, it'd be great.
I'm not really sure whose responsibility that might turn. It's Ricky. Okay.
I'm gonna take that question and tell you that. So I had a long conversation with Kathy Mercer, who is at Regan Streif, and they've been talking to manufacturers for a long, long time because they don't really mind if their loincoat gets distributed. In fact, they like that. So, and according to her, there are several manufacturers that have their whole stuff loinked, but unfortunately, they're not putting it out somewhere, and we don't know why. She's asked them, I think 11 years ago, to do that, and it's, we don't know why. So we did have under the direction and really under the power of Dr. Steve Hinrichs from Nebraska, created this pilot project with the CDC Influenza Lab, who's providing the PCR kit for the public health labs. When they go to FDA to include that in their package insert. And so, in fact, I think as we speak, that package insert is being printed. Turns out the loincoats themselves are not going to be on that package insert. However, there's going to be a link to a place where you can get the loincoats and the related SNOMED codes for them. The reason for that being that if there are any changes to a name for that code, they would have to go through the entire FDA review process to change the package insert. So one reason to not have the loincoats in the package insert themselves is because it would require, any changes would require recertification through FDA, and that's an arduous process. However, there's no reason not to put a URL in. And the feedback I heard, and Desiree, correct me if I'm wrong, is that FDA was excited and thought that was a good idea to have that. And so they supported this pilot, so it at least some explanatory language about electronic reporting and the reasons for loincoat SNOMED codes will go in the package insert with a link to where you can find the ones for this one. And hopefully from that, FDA will create a process. So at least for every new kit that comes out, we'll have loincoat SNOMED codes. And then at the last Loinc Lab meeting, there was a group of instrument vendors that actually has committed themselves to produce loincoats for all their instrument outputs. So I don't know what the time frame is for that, but they have promised that any instrument that you're interfacing with will have loincoats. And I pointed out maybe you could add the SNOMED code if they're not numeric, and they said they might consider it. So we'll see where that goes. But I think we finally have enough momentum and enough people wanting to do electronic reporting that the pressure is on to get that going.
So the reason why, could you re-explain why it isn't actually printed in a package insert, it's actually pointing to a website? What was that again?
So for the package insert, any changes to the package insert, you have to go back again through FDA review.
Mm-hmm.
And so if for example, what happened with exactly this package insert is when H1N1 first came out, it was called the swine flu. Right, mm-hmm. And then people decided that's probably not a good name for it.
The pig farmer site. So,
exactly. Yeah. So the first loincoat short name had swine-like in there.
Okay.
And now it's called 2009 H1. Mm-hmm. So that name change would have prompted a whole new review. So in order to not have to do that, we want to point to a website.
Any other questions for the group?
This might actually be a little off topic, but I think it's relevant. You know, all these interactions that go on, you know, out of the limbs and then back into the limbs. We're continually going back and forth, you know, whether we get into HIE or, you know, EHR, we're always going in and out. Now, usually that process is using XML. I mean, out of the limbs, it's usually that, and then it's transformed to pipes, and then goes back into the limbs. It goes from the pipe back to the XML. But it's really, you know, I find it really complicated. All these tools, all these different versions of HL7, you know, the OULs and ORUs and the different versions. Is there any possibility of using style sheets within the XML to help standardize these different HL7? Versions that we're using? I mean, if we're trying to go with standardization here, I just, I kind of came to this conference thinking we were getting closer. Now, as I understand it better, going to particularly a session yesterday that you were at, Ricky, was, you know, I came out feeling, oh my gosh, we're further away than I thought we were with standardization. So if we're ever talking about hubs or, you know, trying to have any sort of collaborative effort, you know, to bring data from large labs and, you know, public health labs together, you know, we got to get more standardized. So anyways, my question is are there, can we use style sheets within XML, or are there other mechanisms that we can use that would allow us to, you know, use an XML process? I mean, that's what the world seems to be working on now, is XML, you know, to try to be more standardized.
Do you want that?
Well, I can just make a comment. I can't speak directly to that, but the MQF website had put out essentially, you know, Rhapsody definitions, and had a messaging workbench file, which is basically a kind of a style sheet. And then it got pulled back because of some
intellectual property
with HSM. So yeah, that was my comment to Austin, was, you know, they should come out with a, when it came out with a message guide, they should have a machine readable version, essentially a style sheet with it. But I don't know if we can actually directly affect that.
Well, you can, if you build a profile in HL7 messaging workbench, you have an XML, you can have an XML profile that you can then import into your integration engine. The problem with that is we have one, but we can't distribute it. You have to be an HL7 member. You have to get it through HL7. The other thing is that you don't have to send the version 2 messages from 2.5 and higher in pipe delimited. You can send it in XML. There is an HL7 conversion standard on how to do that. And in fact, was it Happy or? Yeah, I think Happy. One of the HL7 reading tools, your parsing tools, you can download pretty cheaply. We'll do that. We'll convert it from pipe to XML, make it easier to read. So that's not an issue. And if we want to decide, you know, as a group to say, okay, don't create pipes, create it in XML, I don't think that's an issue. So it's doable. And, you know, if we're going the next step to CDA eventually, you know, that's XML altogether. But I think we're not quite there yet. You know, when Flip started in 2006, we really wanted to do 2.5 at that point in time, and everybody said, no, we're not ready. So, you know, that's why we're still at 2.3.1 at this point in time. Now everybody is at 2.5.1 and ready for it because of meaningful use. The standard's actually at 2.7 or V3. So, you know, when you have something that's working, it's always hard to, you know, move it to that next level.
I do have a slight different tack to your question, Jack. You know, talk about XML and style sheets. Another way I'm looking at it is, like, XML is your content, you know, the superset data, the basic content, whatever you want to call it, and then style sheet is basically filtering that content to your respective recipients of your information, right? So you know, whether we implemented an XML or style sheets, regardless, I think the fundamental of that concept needs to be advocated and promoted more. And ELR 2.5.1 guide, I do see that, you know, you got one set of content that could be used for three different use cases, even though the primary use case is from a lab to a public health agency as a reportable condition. But there are other two use cases within that guide which mentions that the same data could be used for these other purposes as well. So now whether you use your integration engine to do the XML to the XSL kind of style sheet format, or pipe delimited or filters, but you're still able to do a lot of reuse and not stress the LIMS system and, you know, the LIMS part of the organization with a lot of different interfaces. You still have one content, and you're able to use your integration engine to send it to different people because you already have the content. So that's another perspective, I guess. But a great question.
Share my experience. This is Joy Liao from Arkansas. What I heard from this gentleman is like feeling overwhelmed with maybe the messaging guide. It's over 200 pages. You know, each field has maybe 10 subfields to it. I mean, before we started with Flip, I mean, my boss told me that we need to get on messaging. But every time I look at the messaging guide, I say, no way, I don't understand this. But what we learned is when Pat Team came to Arkansas, they told us there are only 15 fields are required. So that makes everything so much easier. So with your situation, I think you just need to find out which 15 or 20 are needed, and then going from there, then everything will be much easier. Now, at this conference, when the presenters are showing the HL7 2.3 messages, I know them because I've worked with them. Everything looks so familiar. I like them instead of, oh, no way, I cannot do those. So my comment is just working from that 20 or 25 required fields and going from there, it'll be okay.
Yeah.
Eric, we softened them up for you.
Yes, we did.
James is still recovering from the Patty's trip.
Well, he has to face Limzai first, so.
Any other questions for the group? Well, I want to thank Srinath, Ricky, and Eric for this, and I thank you all for coming. If you...
No, thank you.
I did see a lot of our grantees right here in the room, like Susan and
If you'd like a little more information on the projects, there are some handouts on the project specifically at the APHL booth. I apologize I didn't bring it with me. And
you can handle
if you have any questions
more.
For more detail from the group, okay. Feel free to ask. And as a last connection, if you need any information, you can write us at flip@aphl.org, and we can connect you to the right people. Thank you.